Probably everybody knows, at least that we had a guest presenter, this is Mr. Creekmore. He's teaching a class, I think it's 212.
GP 212, yes.
And he works at Pikeworks. Uh-huh. I can't describe what you do. So he's been gracious enough to come talk about basics of encrypted network communication.
Yeah. So, okay, my name is Jonathan Creekmore. I started out doing routers, working on routers. Spent 7, 8, 9 more years than I can want to remember working for Adatran doing router firmware and router hardware. About 3.5 years ago, I left, went to a small company called Pikeworks. They are basically a cybersecurity company. Got bought by Raytheon last year, so now we're Raytheon Pikeworks. Still do the same thing, all cybersecurity. Most of what I've been doing has been dealing with network communications. We do lots of different things, anti-tamper, and we do some offensive, some defensive, but my focus has been network communication because of my past. So I thought I would give a talk about just protecting conversations in general, specifically network communications, and just kind of give you a basic overview of it. Nothing I say is gospel. You should not take what I say and go try to implement your own secure protocols, because I'm leaving stuff out. There are a lot of subtleties in implementing both network protocols and secure network protocols. So if you need to use one, don't follow this. Use TLS, OpenSSL, something like that. That will get you a lot farther along, a lot faster, and it will be a lot more secure. But as a basic overview, so way back in the long, long, long ago, people wanted to have conversations with remote parties. They would have to send a message of some sort. They could either do a carrier pigeon, or you could send a runner, or something like that. But you know, you did not have physical communication, no voice communication, no visual communications. You had to trust some other medium to get your message across. There are two main problems with that. One, the message can be intercepted in transit. If it's a carrier pigeon, it can be shot down. If it was a messenger taking it, do you trust the messenger? Do you trust the messenger is secure enough, you know, has enough guards or whatever to get through without being captured? Do you trust the messenger enough that he won't sell your secrets to the enemy? So, if the message is ever captured, anybody could have read them. So that's one danger. The other danger is, you as the receiver of this message, how do you have any guarantees that the person that sent the message to you is who they say they are? You just received a message and it says it's from your friendly general. Do you have any guarantees of it? Anybody could have sent the message. If you receive a runner, well, if you've not ever seen that runner before, what guarantee do you have that it came from the other general? So you can't be sure who sent that message that you've just now received. So those are the two main problems with trying to have remote communications with somebody else. And it basically breaks down to either authentication problems or an encryption problem. So for the purposes of this, I'm going to say authentication is the act of confirming the integrity of a message and the identity of the person that sent it. That may not be the exact definition that you would always use, but for our purposes, it's good enough. It's making sure that nobody has tampered with that message, and it's going to make sure that the person that sent it is who they say they are. The other side of that is protecting the contents of the message from prying eyes with encryption. Some sort of cipher to encode the messages so that eavesdroppers can't read it, but the authorized parties on the other end could. Okay, so and there were a lot of early attempts at protection. So one way to authenticate a message would be to use some sort of a wax seal on a physical letter to kind of guarantee that this message came from who they said it was. You know, if you're a duke, and you had a signet ring. Only you had that ring, so only you could have sealed that message up. To go down the runner path, if you send a runner that is known to both parties, well, that runner is a form of authentication. We know it came from the other person because I trust the person that brought me the message, and I know him, so I'm going to trust his message. Another very early way of doing it in this way, encryption, would be like a Caesar cipher. So a Caesar cipher is just a simple substitution cipher where you rotate characters around. In this case, like the quick box becomes a garbled string of characters. Really easy to reverse engineer, but we're talking the early days and the long, long, long ago, before there were computers and people were having to do all this by hand. All of these early techniques set the foundations for things that we do now. Okay, so time goes on, we get more and more advanced protection. So by World War II, we have the Enigma machine that produced quote-unquote uncrackable ciphers. We couldn't just reverse engineer the cipher. We had to have the physical machine to figure out how were they doing this. And even once we knew how they were encrypting the message, we still had to invent computers to try all these different keys and finally crack the codes. But for the most part, they were uncrackable at that time. Also, we were able to do signatures, watermarks, to give some measure of confidence in the identity of the sender. I also talk about shared secrets. So sometimes in a message, you might add code phrases or something like that to the message so that the other person knows that, well, he sent that code phrase, so it's likely the other party. But it's some sort of a signature that lets us know that the other side is who they say they are. Okay, so then we invent computers, and we invent networking. And we take a huge step back, because by the 1950s or so, we've gotten relatively advanced in, you know, protecting messages between remote parties. Until Unix comes along, and we forgot all of those lessons, because the machines were very underpowered, and mainly used for research purposes, so everybody trusted each other. And we invented all these protocols like Telnet, and FTP, and SNMP, and IMAP, and all of these protocols that passed a bunch of information back and forth in the clear. Since everybody trusted everybody else, they would pass passwords back and forth, data gets transmitted in the clear. So you kind of lost a bunch of the security mindset that we had going through history. So we had to start bringing cryptography, modern cryptography, to secure these network protocols. And there are three main, I guess, cryptographic operations that are used in network protocols. You've got your symmetric ciphers, which, correct me if I'm wrong, you talked about symmetric and asymmetric ciphers and such last week, maybe?
We went into cryptographic hashes a little bit.
Okay, so you went into all of this a little bit. Okay. So symmetric ciphers, asymmetric ciphers, and cryptographic hashes. And I'll talk a little bit about how they're used in network protocols and then go more into depth of what the protocols are using them for. I'll kind of skim that bit. Okay, so with symmetric ciphers, it's pretty simple. Single key is used for both encryption and decryption. Now, there's slightly different methods to encrypt and decrypt, but that key is the shared secret between the two parties. Generally pretty fast, relatively fast anyway, compared to asymmetric ciphers. The more popular algorithms are moved into hardware for speed purposes. These days, it's not uncommon to have hardware chips that implement triple DES natively. A lot of them now are implementing AES natively. Intel has even added instructions for accelerating AES. So,
I believe AMD has as well, but I could be wrong.
Very, very likely. I know Intel has, and AMD tends to follow them pretty quickly. I say AES is preferable because TripleDES has been more or less deprecated by the government. AES is now the new standard that the government has gone to. It's advanced encryption standard. Key sizes are bigger. It's just a stronger encryption algorithm. So asymmetric ciphers are the other side of this. Instead of having a single shared secret, you have two separate mathematically linked keys, or what we call key pairs, one for encryption, one for decryption. The encryption key is public. So anybody can know your public key, encrypt a message for you, you're the only one that can decrypt it. At that point, the person that encrypted the message can't even decrypt it again. The secret key, the private key, is the only one that can decrypt it. Typically slower than symmetric ciphers. Orders of magnitude slower. I'm trying to remember, for some tests I did with AES, I could encrypt a roughly page size, 4,096 bytes of data in microseconds, I think, with AES. We're talking on the order of many, many, many milliseconds for RSA. I think RSA 1024 versus AES 256. And you're talking three orders of magnitude difference, more maybe, I don't remember. Four, I think. Because I think it was like 10 versus like 100 milliseconds or something like that. So a lot of the ones you'll see DSA some. DSA is kind of frowned upon now as older. RSA is pretty common. ECC is becoming really common and more popular because that's really easy to do in hardware, or a lot easier to do in hardware, a lot faster to do in hardware.
And it's computationally more expensive.
Elliptic curve cryptography, yes. I actually don't know a whole lot about ECC other than what it is and kind of how it works. That's not one of the ones that we use, so I don't know. I know more about RSA than I know about ECC. But then we get into cryptographic hashes. So the third prong in that set of cryptographic operations. So any type of hash function takes a large amount of data and doesn't compress it, but turns it into a fixed size string. And a cryptographic hash is supposed to be very good at doing that. It's designed so that small, minute changes in data cause huge changes in the output. Usually we'll use it with a symmetric or an asymmetric cipher to produce what's called an HMAC, a hash-based method, message authentication code. So the HMAC can be used to protect message integrity and authenticity, which all that means is we're going to sign the hash in some manner so that we have hashed the data, we know the data is correct, and by signing it, we know that it's the same data that was sent. So the data wasn't tampered with in transit. Typically, you'll see things like MD5, SHA-1, SHA-256. MD5 is frowned upon because that's been broken, but you'll still see it a lot for file checksums, that type of thing. SHA-1, not as great, generally still works okay. SHA-256 is, or the SHA-2 series, really. SHA-256, I think 512 is considered the SHA-2 series. Those are more generally acceptable, and that's kind of the route the government has taken. And if you hear me talking about this is what the government's done, this is what the government's done, work for a government contractor, so we have to kind of follow what they specify as the acceptable algorithms to use. Okay, so now we want to get into actually protecting network traffic. Well, the very simple way of doing it is you call somebody up on the phone and say, here's what my network encryption key is going to be, and I'm going to send you this message. And I'll encrypt it with this message, or with this key. You can decrypt it with the same key, and we're good. Well, problem with that is, it prevents traffic from being ciphered. We sent it across. But anybody who could read the message could have sent it, because all it takes is having the key to encrypt it. So anybody that knows the key can encrypt a message and pretend to be the sender. It can be time-consuming to set up. You have to share these keys back and forth. So you either have to have some expensive setup time where you share lots of keys that can be used over and over again, or you're going to set up one key and just continuously reuse it. So this was pretty quickly gone away from, doing just a pre-shared key. You'll see it. This technique comes back for once you get into key generation, but that is on a per-session basis. So, but pre-shared key still has its uses. A lot of times, if you're trying to just exchange a file with somebody and they don't have GPG or anything like that set up, you might still pre-share a key and either use like a PDF, encrypted PDF, something like that. We'd use the same type of technique. But it's not really conducive to automatic network encryption by pre-sharing those keys. So one way you could do it is go into public key encryption. Well, what did I say? Public key is very, very slow, or generally very, very slow. You also wind up having the problem that packets are going to be limited to the size of your key pair. So if you're doing RSA encryption with like a 1024-bit RSA key, you only get like 111, I think it's 111 bytes, it may be 117, of actual message, because you have to pad it out to kind of verify the RSA was correct when you decrypt it. So you can either chop your packets up into multiple RSA operations, or you have just little bitty packets, and that's all you can put in there. But to go to arbitrary message links, you get multiple RSA operations that you have to do for every message. And like I said, that's slow. You don't want to do that. However, it gives you the ability to sign in the messages pretty easily. If you've got public key pairs on both sides, you can encrypt with the other person's public key, sign it with your private key, and now they can verify the signature on the other side and decrypt the message. So it works. It's just not optimal. But these same techniques wind up being used in more advanced protocols. And this and the pre-shared key, nobody ever actually does this for network encryption, but it's useful for sharing files back and forth. So this goes back to the asymmetric model. The more or less GPG model of encryption is to have an arbitrary size file, and instead of using RSA to encrypt the file, what we'll do is we'll generate a random key, AES encrypt the file, or the plain text, then we will RSA encrypt that random key, append it to the front of the file. Then we create a message hash of all of that file text, and then sign that, and that whole chunk can be sent back and forth. So that works fairly well for network encryption as well. I mean, it's more or less what GPG uses, but you can use it for network encryption with no problems, because it gives you the ability to send a whole message of arbitrary length, and most of the message is encrypted using very fast symmetric ciphers. It's just the encrypting the symmetric key that's slow and signing it that's slow, and then of course verifying on the other end. But it gives you a lot of flexibility. So you can take this model and move forward into, like I said, the more advanced models later on. So then we get into Diffie-Hellman key exchange. Now we finally get to a point where we're going to take some math to generate a key without ever having to transmit it between the two parties. Diffie-Hellman is kind of the basis for what most modern network encryption protocols use. So basically this allows two parties to, without any prior knowledge of each other, to establish a shared secret key over an insecure channel without exchanging that key back and forth. Downside is no authentication is provided at all. The key exchange is completely anonymous. That could be an upside as well, if you want it to be completely anonymous. But what you lose here is authentication of the channel. This just gives you encryption. So to crack that, you wind up having to solve the discrete logarithm problem. So all that really means is that the numbers used are so large that it takes entirely too long to try to factor out the parameters that would allow you to derive the key. And I'll go through the Diffie-Hellman key exchange in just a minute and kind of show you where all the pieces come from. But the best known algorithms that we have today can't reverse Diffie-Hellman in a reasonable amount of time for the sizes of the numbers that we talked about. Okay, so Diffie-Hellman key exchange. So we're going to set up Alice and Bob because everybody likes to use Alice and Bob. They want to talk to each other. So Alice wants to send a message to Bob first. Alice generates a secret number, A. A is a very, very, very large random number on the order of hundreds of digits long. Alice also generates P, which is a very, very, very large prime number on the same order of magnitude, and G, which is the basis of these exponents. Generally pretty small. Typically you see like 3 or 5 is used. And it sends, Alice sends P and G to the other side. Those can be set up ahead of time, but it's usually pretty easy just to go ahead and send it. Generating P, one thing about P is P has to be prime. So that is the most like compute intensive part of this, because anybody can generate a very large very large number. Verifying that it's prime is a lot more difficult. So Bob on the other side receives P and G, creates his own secret number. Once again, a large number of hundreds of digits long. So now Alice has to create what's called the public data that gets sent to the other side, capital A. All capital A is G to the power of A modulus that big prime number, and that becomes A. So a modulus on a prime number is what's known as a group. You can get into some modern algebra and learn all about groups and fields and rings, and it's really cool stuff. But all you really have to know is that this operation is kind of closed, so that operations mod some number tend to work like operations without the modulus. That's all you really need to know about it for this purpose. So it creates A. Now A is G to power of little a. Little a is secret. This is where the discrete logarithm problem comes into play. So from big A, it's very, 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 very difficult to reverse and get little a. Even though you know what this G number is, you have to solve that logarithm, and it's compute intensive. So we can send A in the clear across the channel. Bob receives it, winds up computing his own, capital B, in the same manner, sends it across. At this point, both sides have P, G, and A, and B. And so from those pieces of data, they can generate S. Now, S is generated with the other side's public number raised to the power of your side's private number. So Bob's public number raised to Alice's private number, modulus P, comes up to the secret, the shared secret. Same thing on the other side. Alice's number raised to Bob's private number, modulus P, equals the shared secret. The reason why that works is because of this mod P. Because we're going to wrap around that, whatever the prime number is, and come back around to it. That's why that piece, why they wind up coming up to the exact same number. Okay. So, you basically can get into cap B to the A equals cap A to the B, which winds up being G to the B to the A equals G to the A to the B. And if you remember your logarithms, the B to the A and the A to the B, they multiply by each other as commutative. So they're the same number on both sides. But you can't figure out what A is from that, so an attacker can't see it. So now you've come up with a way of generating a secret number from the public data and from your own size secret. And now you have a shared key that was never transmitted across the network that can be used to encrypt all further traffic that's sent across the network. So that's kind of the basics of Diffie-Hellman. Diffie-Hellman's almost never really used anymore, though, because it has that anonymous feeling to it. Yes, I've generated a shared key, but I have no idea that the person I'm talking to is who I want to be talking to. What if a man-in-the-middle attack comes in and somebody pretends to be my peer? Well, I'm going to negotiate a shared key with them. They'll negotiate a shared key with the person I want to be talking to, and they can now decrypt all the messages in between. So that's badness. We don't want to do that. So we need to extend the whole Diffie-Kellman key exchange again with something that's called station-to-station protocol. That takes the same Diffie-Hellman key exchange and adds those asymmetric ciphers back into it. Kind of. So the basic protocol is the same as it was before, but we're going to send the certificates, which is the public key of each side, across the network. Now those public keys, you have to have either some sort of a certificate authority that you can verify it against, or with something like SSL, you'll get a fingerprint that you can verify the fingerprint with the other side. But those certificates also have host name information built into it. So when I receive the certificate, I can verify the signature of it. I can verify the host name of the certificate is the host name I think I'm talking to. And that gives me a certain measure of confidence that I'm talking to the other side. Certain measure of confidence. The rest of the confidence comes from this signature. So basically what we're going to do there is once we've generated that secret key, we're going to encrypt a signature of the public data in a certain order. So we've received a certificate, which we can use to verify, we verify that this is good, that this is the host name we think we're talking to. The signature had to have the private key to create the signature. The other side had to have the private key to create the signature. So we can verify that, and then this encryption here protects that signature, so that signature can't be cloned. So this allows us to put some measure of authentication between the two hosts. But conceptually, it's very similar to Diffie-Hellman. It's a very simple extension to it. Now, one thing I've done in the past, which is not what I told you not to do, working with my own protocol, we had some tight constraints, and we didn't want to use public key certificates, so we used a pre-shared key that we could use to sign and verify. So we weren't sure about the exact neighbor, you know, I didn't know that host B was really who he said he was, but I knew he was one of a group that was okay to talk to. So that kind of works okay. But this is the way that OpenSSL more or less works. This is the way IPsec more or less works. OpenVPN, because all that is OpenSSL, more or less works in this manner. This is the basis that they all basically came from. Okay, so station-to-station generates a symmetric cipher between the node hosts. You can securely transmit data back and forth, but there are still other attacks that you're vulnerable to. So yeah, we've authenticated the traffic. We can encrypt the traffic. But now we have specifically three that I'm going to talk about. Replay attacks, data modification attacks, and very limited side channel attacks. I'm not going to get a whole lot into side channel attacks, but I'm only going to talk about one specific to a protocol, not the broad class of side channels. Okay, so what is a replay attack? Well, an attacker can capture all of this encrypted network traffic with no problems. Attacker doesn't know the contents of the message, can't know the contents of the message because it's encrypted. But the attacker, if they're smart enough, can see messages come across, look at what happens on the other side, and infer certain things about those messages. And if they really want to, they can replay those messages in the future to replicate those effects that they've observed. So what if a message is being sent to a missile silo and it causes a missile to fire? Well, what if you were able to just replay that message over and over again and just cause the silo to waste all of its missiles? Now you've lost all your defense for the next set of incoming missiles that are coming in. So we can use what's called a NOS on all of our encrypted messages to protect the traffic. Sequence numbers work really well for NOSes, but all a NOS is a number used once. And in the case of a network communications, each session keeps its own set of NOSes. So you generally will create keys for that session. You'll bring the session up because I've started communicating with that host. And then you'll use these NOSes only once per session, or a sequence number that is monotonically incrementing across that entire session. Sequence numbers work really well because it makes it super easy to track the received messages and know when you've seen one before. So a lot of times what you'll wind up seeing, and what the IP spec especially suggests you use, is what's called a sliding window. And you keep a bitmap of messages and the last known sequence number. And say you start out at zero, so I haven't seen anything. I get to sequence number one. Well, I set the bitmap, set the last known sequence number to one. If I don't get two, that's fine, but I get three in. Well, I'm going to shift two because I'm two numbers above where I was. So now my bitmap is all zeros, a one, a zero, and a one. My last known sequence number is three. Then I get two in. Well, now I can go back and fill in that second bit, and I don't need to update the bitmap any further. I don't change the last seen sequence number. Now if I see three again, oh, that bit's already set. I know I've seen it. I throw it away. The sliding window only allows so many bits, typically like 64 bits. So you make the assumption that if you receive a packet that's outside the back end of that sliding window, you just assume you've seen it and automatically throw it away. It's not perfect, but it allows you to handle reordering of packets in transit and works fairly well in practice. Okay, so data modification is another attack. A lot harder to do, but what you can do is corrupt messages in transit. You don't know what you're doing. You're just going to change this encrypted message, which you know is going to cause a wildly different output on the other end. Well, a lot of software is poorly written. and just assumes that the packets it receives are what would have been sent on the other side. If you're doing some sort of a serialization, passing data structures back and forth, a simple, you know, one-bit corruption in the encrypted message could wildly change what you're receiving and crash the software. So you pretty much want to prevent any type of message modification. Well, I can't prevent somebody from tampering with the message in transit, but what I can do is do an HMAC across the entire encrypted message. Well, that lets me see that the message came from the other side, that individual messages came from the other side because they signed the message, but I have a hash of the message contents. If that hash doesn't match, then I can just throw the message away. I never even have to decrypt it because I know that the message has been tampered with. If you are doing something like TCP and you're tunneling TCP on top of some encrypted protocol, TCP will worry about retransmitting, so no harm, no foul. If you're doing UDP, you have to deal with the retransmits on your own anyway, so once again, no harm, no foul. Since they're signed by the message sender, somebody can't change the message and just regenerate the hash. The other side had to have signed it. So the last one I'm going to talk about is side channel attacks. I don't know how much you went into side channel on last meeting.
Didn't even touch it.
Okay. So side channel attacks, there's a lot of different side channel attacks. The one I want to really talk about is specific to network protocols, but side channel attacks are all about gaining information from the implementation of the system, not from the algorithm itself, and not from brute forcing the algorithm. So a lot of things you'll see for side channel attacks is things like DPA, what's discrete power analysis, differential power analysis. So by looking at the difference in power output when you're decrypted, you can regenerate the key from that. You have to be very careful with it, but you can do it. But that has nothing to do with the network protocol itself. That's just an attack on the cipher. One thing that is a side channel attack for a network protocol is the message length. Granted, when you do a symmetric cipher, you have to, if you're doing a block cipher, you wind up having to pad out to the block size. A lot of cases, it's like 16 byte blocks. Some network protocols, like IPsec, which is the one I know the best, allows you to add additional padding bytes. So IPsec allows you to add up to 256 padding bytes to every message. So you can make these messages as big or small as you want, effectively. It adds overhead to your network, but somebody who's capturing traffic can't reliably tell which message you sent, because each time you send it, it could be a different size. So it's a lot harder to determine what the real length of the plaintext is, and a lot harder to determine which plaintext message you sent in the first place, which class of message you sent. Okay. So encrypted protocols really are insufficient. Encrypted protocols really only protect the data in transit. And what that data in transit means is different for every protocol. So I can go in and I can encrypt all of my communications with my mail server, with my IMAP server, and that's great. You know, my password exchange is good. My message going to that server is encrypted. But there's no guarantee about any security in between the mail servers. Most often, they're all sent in the clear. The entire message would be. It also doesn't have any guarantee about the storage. A lot of mail servers would cache the messages in between, would store the messages, and then forward them on. It all comes down to, that winds up not being a network encryption problem. The network message was encrypted here, between the sender and the receiver. So a lot of times, encrypting your protocol isn't enough. You have to think about the data at rest as well as the data in transit. And so something like GPG works really well for that. So even though you're encrypting the traffic going across the network, and you might be double encrypting it because you've encrypted the message already. Something like this will protect you in the case where the data is sitting on a hard drive somewhere.
Okay. So kind of to sum everything up,
authentication and encryption are what's used to secure the transmission between two remote parties. It prevents your attackers from being able to read those messages and gives you some measure of assurance as to who the sender is. Simply providing encryption alone is not enough to secure the messages. If you don't know who the other side was, you don't know whether to trust the message that you received. As well, you also need to think about your data at rest as well as your data in transit to have a complete end-to-end solution when you're designing a network protocol or any type of encryption protocol.
So that was kind of quick, high-level overview of network encryption. Those are the basics of it. Like I said, the station-to-station protocol is the basis of both TLS. TLS is more complicated, but the key exchange and authentication portion is pretty similar. It's the basis of IKE, which is the Internet Key Exchange, which is used to set up dynamic sessions between in an IPsec tunnel. And that's really about it. Most of the techniques like the replay attack and the side channel attack are implemented, or defense are implemented by IPsec. I've not looked in depth at TLS. I'm pretty sure TLS does something similar.
I actually just read a problem today where they were had broken an old but common reused version of TLS.
I read about that.
Lucky 13, I think they were calling it.
Yeah, it's an interesting topic because it's theoretically broken. I mean, they've shown they can do it in a lab where you send, what was it, millions of messages?
8 million connections.
Yeah.
Connections required. It was a little ridiculous.
Yeah, it's a little on the extreme side, but yeah. So I mean, even TLS, which has been doing this for years and years and years, there can still be issues with it. So that's why I say, just an overview. Don't go off and implement your own encryption. Don't do it. Are there any questions? I can answer any questions that you might have.
Yeah. It would be good if you mentioned GPG a little bit more about that, because probably a lot of people in here are familiar with GPG and OpenPGP.
Okay. I just assumed you went over that last week.
We were pressed on time.
Okay.
So I think I mentioned it briefly, but I was trying to keep it really high level because I didn't have a lot of time.
Yeah, I didn't know how high or low level to go. Okay, so GPG is all based on asymmetric ciphers. Pretty sure they use RSA. I'm almost certain they use RSA.
I could have sworn I remember.
I think you can
delete them all, but I can't remember.
Do it? I think you can choose different ones. Because I remember seeing you can do a DSA as well, and but I'm pretty sure my GPG key is an RSA key. Almost certain it's an RSA 2048. Not saying that they can't use OpenMall. I've looked a little bit at the GPG spec. But so GPG, the really cool thing about GPG is, like I said, it generates a random symmetric key and encrypts your message with that random symmetric key. But you can send the same message to multiple parties. So what it does is it creates a block, kind of like a decryption header block, where for every party you want to send it to, it will encrypt that key, that symmetric key, with their public keys. And so you have just a list of these encrypted symmetric keys. Once you've received that file, GPG will effectively go through each of those blocks, try to decrypt it. And if it can decrypt it, yay, now it has a symmetric key and can decrypt the file. If it can't, it'll walk all the way through the list until it runs out and says, I can't decrypt the file. The really cool thing about RSA is you have a measure of validation inside RSA with its padding scheme to know that you decrypted the file correctly.
or that you've decrypted the cipher block correctly. Generally, what you do with GPG is also sign the message as well. GPG has what's called the Web of Trust, which I kind of know about at the high level. But what the Web of Trust is there is no certifying authority with GPG. So there is no VeriSign saying that, well, this key is good, this certificate is good. It depends on you knowing somebody and them signing your key to say, well, I trust that this key is for this person. And say I signed Eugene's key. Well, then people that trusted me could evaluate how trustworthy I am to saying that Eugene is who he says he is. And so then they could implicitly trust Eugene is who he says he is based off of my signature. So the Web of Trust gets into how much you trust other people and how much you trust other people to verify further people. I don't want to say it's complicated because conceptually it's kind of easy, but you wind up having a good bit of setup to deal with it. A lot of times you'll see what's called key signing parties where people will meet in real life and exchange their keys and sign them so that they can extend that web of trust. GPG also has a way of sharing keys with public key servers that once you've gotten a bunch of these signatures on your key, you can upload it to the public key server. And if you want to send to somebody, you can download their key from the public key server and send directly to them. I don't really know where else to go on GPG.
And on the covers.
Yeah, it's kind of a high level.
It's based off the open PGP spec. It originally,
yeah.
The idea originated with PGP, which was pretty good privacy.
Right.
By Zimmerman.
Zimmerman in like 91?
Yeah.
Old.
I think so. Because he was having legal issues for a short time because the RSA was trying to sue him, but then their patent expired very shortly thereafter.
Yeah, because that's from the 70s. So.
Yeah. 20 years.
Yeah. So GPG is based on that, and I think GPG is probably more widely used now than PGP is.
It is.
And that GPG is GNU Privacy Guard or something. I don't remember what that is.
Technically, I think it's pretty much anything that's based off the spec, the open PGP
right.
spec.
Right, but I mean, that's what it stands
most
for.
Most people are using GPG now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the annoying thing about GPG is, well, I have an iPhone. You can't use it on the iPhone. Not really.
Have you looked at ICG now?
I have not. Basically, I don't want to copy mail messages back and forth and
so
all that.
That one has some degree of integration. Mm-hmm. Where I used to work, the director there had wanted to set up, because he and I had set up Thunderbird and Enigma, and he was looking around and he found that. I've got a write-up on my site that I could email.
Okay.
It's like a 4-month app, so it's not free, but it's not horrible.
Yeah, the one thing that almost made me want to go to Android was K9 Mail, because that's supposed to be really good for it.
It works quite well.
Yeah. We use GPG for all of our internal communications at Pikeworks, partially because we're too cheap to pay for certificates for everybody, which would be a lot better, but... because all of our customers have the ability to use certificates. None of our customers use GPG. But we use it all internally because our founders are paranoid and don't want the data, even internal data, unencrypted.
Well, and the signing aspect is pretty big deal, too.
The signing aspect is a big deal, but the people that we really want to sign it don't, like, the C-level employees, yeah, they'll never sign their emails. Because they don't want to... type in their password every time they send an email. Because they apparently can't say, save it in my keychain. And
well, actually, I'm a little bit nervous how aggressive GPG agent has gotten about caching the password. I need to figure out how to reconfigure it on my
computer. You can change it.
I'm aware of that, but their default configuration also allows it to Spanish. So if you were using a laptop
and
stolen, somebody could get your password because it's cached in memory.
Yeah. So I've used Thunderbird's Enigmail. I like Enigmail. I don't like Thunderbird because every time I download Thunderbird and install it on my Mac, it eats the CPU because it's got a bug in it in the latest versions that just sit there and consume cores. I actually use Apple Mail with the, GPG Mail plugin. I've done a little bit of work on the GPG Mail plugin because one of my customers that we actually had using GPG sent a set of bad messages. They encrypted it wrong, and it caused GPG Mail to kill Apple Mail. Like, it would try to read the message, and it would exception. So I got in there and kind of messed around with it a little bit until I hacked around the problem, and it's basically they weren't handling the exception correctly. So I know a little bit about their code base, but it's not bad. I've looked a little bit at the GPG spec, and it's interesting.
Yeah.
I have something else I was going to say on that, but I don't remember what it is, so it's on the ether. Any other questions? Or any questions?
I was just wanting to verify the modulus. Mm-hmm. That is the remainder of division, or the...
Yes.
Summation. Okay.
Remainder of division. Yeah. So like I said, so if you really get interested in encryption, I highly recommend Modern Algebra class, going into rings and fields and all of that, because RSA is based on that, Diffie-Hellman is all based on that, and it's all prime number, it's either prime number factorization or that discrete logarithm problem cover a lot of it. You can get into the whole elliptic curve thing, and that's taking different points on an ellipse and using that to encrypt. I'm not entirely certain how that works. Like I said, I just know the basics. But the general math concepts behind that are pretty easy. I have a book. It's a Dover Mathematics book. It's like Introduction to Modern Mathematics or something like that. And it's got a good quarter of the book. I mean, it's thin book, and thin book. Good quarter of the book is based on rings and fields and groups, and that gives you enough background to really understand all of those concepts. Things like symmetric algorithms, if you've had linear algebra, will be very familiar because it's all matrix manipulation. It's the shuffles and rotates and things like that for our matrices. So linear algebra is pretty cool for that, but I like the modern algebra approach. So that's kind of what I study in my spare time.
They covered a bit of it in Stanford cryptos.
Did they?
But they didn't go into detail because it wasn't that long of a course. Right. I didn't make it find time to go study it. But.
Yeah, see, I didn't... The book I read didn't have anything about encryption in it. It's just I knew enough about the encryption to know, hey, these are the topics that it's in.
Exactly.
And so I went and learned the math, and now I have a much better understanding of the encryption algorithm.
And that's what I want to apply time to at some point.
Yeah. It's not practical in any sense. It's just a, hey, I know how this works. I mean, if I were a crypto analyst or something, then yes, that might be practical.
But it's fun stuff.
But it's fun stuff to learn. Now I remember the other thing I was wanting to say. One of the really cool things, especially with the network encryption and encryption in general, is doing formal models with it, which we don't do at work, but I always thought would be really cool to learn. And there are a couple of things out there. There's something called the Pi calculus that's for communicating systems, and it basically kind of abstracts messages back and forth. And there's an extension to it called the SPI calculus that is secure Pi calculus, and it adds in all the crypto operations. And so you can prove certain parameters about, or you can do proofs on your network messages and basically try to verify that nobody can crack it from a theoretical standpoint anyway. Like I said, somebody could still do an implementation attack or something like that on it, but... Yeah, that's all I really had, unless anybody else has any questions. I pretty much learned all of this stuff on the job, all the encryption stuff, So in the last 3.5 years or so, I knew the networking stuff from way back, but all the encryption stuff was fairly new. And there's other things you can get into that I didn't cover, but if you're interested, Kerberos is a interesting protocol for authentication between services. So I have one trusted server and can go to that one trusted server to authenticate myself with all the other systems in the network. So that's kind of cool, but the protocol is a little complicated and hard to go through.
It's the basis for LDAP, isn't it?
I don't know if it's the basis for LDAP. I know it's the basis of Active Directory.
Okay.
It's very similar to LDAP.
Yeah.
But it's the basis for the Active Directory protocol. So, I mean, it's still used in an evolved form. So.